Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Deconstructed. I'm Ryan Grimm. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you've seen the movie or read the book, The Big Short. If you haven't, the fact that you were alive in 2008 means you know the gist of the story. Wall Street bankers packaged and sold garbage loans that eventually blew up the global economy, ruining millions of lives in the process and fueling the rise of right-wing authoritarian populism around the world. Other than Teresa Giudice, star of the Bravo TV show Real Housewives of New Jersey, and her husband Joe, basically nobody went to prison for any of it.
Real Housewives getting a bitter taste of reality, a judge sentencing both Teresa and Joe Giudice to prison for fraud.
In announcing their indictment, U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman got cute. Everyone has an obligation to tell the truth when dealing with the courts, paying their taxes, and applying for loans or mortgages. That's reality, he said. Pathetic as that joke at their expense was, his claim was also a lie. Everyone did not, in fact, have an obligation to tell the truth when dealing with loans or mortgages. Wall Street executives had gotten fabulously wealthy in the run-up to the financial crisis by lying about those very things and got bailed out when it all went south. Going after the gaudy Giudices was about as much as federal prosecutors bothered with, catching them fudging some paperwork the same way millions of others did.
You're the one who was in f***ing jail, not me, bitch. I would love to f***ing grab you by the back of your f***ing head.
After locking Joe away in solitary confinement, they even deported him back to Italy, where he hadn't lived since he was a little kid. And since nobody but one real housewife and her now ex-husband paid the price, it's happening again. Today's show is a bit more technical than I usually do, but even if you get lost in acronyms here and there, the broad outline of the story is sadly quite easy to follow, and it's a fascinating one. The one guide I'll offer is this one. CMBS stands for Commercial Mortgage-Backed Securities. Those are similar to RMBS, which stands for, yes, Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities. During the 2008 crisis, banks bundled together a ton of bad mortgages and created a new asset out of them and claimed that since they were now all bundled together, they were no longer risky, and the rating agencies went along. Those new assets are called securities, and they were made up of residential mortgages, hence the name, Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities, or RMBS. Commercial mortgage-backed securities are exactly what they sound like. They're financial products that are backed not by home loans, but by commercial loans. The problem in 2008 was the bankers and brokers were inflating the incomes of people taking out mortgages. This week, in a story in The Intercept, a financial analyst turned whistleblower provided data that bankers appear now to be doing the same for commercial real estate, inflating income and packaging it together into risky assets. So to recap, RMBS, residential securities, the ones you remember from 2008. CMBS, commercial securities. That's what we're talking about today. It's an abbreviation that you may end up becoming very familiar with in the not-too-distant future. I'm joined today by John Schwartz, my colleague who reported this story with me, and John Flynn, the CMBS analyst turned whistleblower who served as our primary source. What John found, through breathtakingly laborious detective work, is an underbelly of the commercial mortgage market that is a lot softer than we might have thought. Well, John Flynn, welcome to Deconstructed.
Thank you.
And John Schwartz, thank you for joining us again here on Deconstructed.
Well, it's great to be here to talk about this extremely complicated but fascinating issue.
It is fascinating. And so, John Flynn, tell us a little bit about how you got here. How did you wind up at a credit rating agency to begin with?
Right. My career started in Tokyo, actually. My clients were Fortune 500 firms looking to enter into the Japanese market. After working there for about 4 years, I joined GMAC Commercial Mortgage, the predecessor to Berkadia. And that's when the Japanese banks were all suffering from non-performing loans. bad credits. And we went around with joint ventures with Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and the likes, purchasing non-performing loans from Japanese banks. And that was really fun. We purchased everything from goose farms to bowling centers to golf courses, et cetera. I'd been in Japan for about 10 years, and I wanted to get a flavor for how things were done in the West because I didn't want to specialize in Japan for the rest of my life and stay there. So I moved to Australia. Mm-hmm. I met my wife, my Australian wife in Tokyo, and we moved to Australia. And after a stint working in development for a CBD tower with Lendlease, I joined Moody's in their ABS, asset-backed security team, where I helped to rate everything from credit card receivables to auto loan receivables to commercial real estate to esoteric privatizations, etc.
So what years were you at Moody's?
In about 2001 to 2002, I think. And during that time, I met the Fitch people in Sydney. And CMBS was taken off in Japan in a big way during that time, and they gave me an offer I couldn't refuse to go back to Tokyo and help them out on their CMBS ratings, but understand that I already had been in Japan for a long time and I wanted to get out. And so I got them to relocate us to Chicago, where the CMBS market was on steroids. Part of my role was to make sure models were consistent across the globe, et cetera. But I started running deals, CRE CDOs, commercial real estate collateralized debt obligations, CRE CDOs. I developed that model, actually.
Right. And these are some of the acronyms we got used to during the previous financial crisis, collateralized debt obligations and the like. Sure.
I worked on those. But my mainstay was Conduit CMBS, Conduit Commercial Mortgage-Backed Securities, CMBS, are groups of about 100 loans put together, diverse portfolios of commercial real estate loans pooled together and sold off into the market. And that was in 2003 or 4 or so. And I saw a lot of things come across my desk that, you know, were just crazy. And, you know, I took that knowledge, put it in my pocket. And in 2006, early 2006, I joined Dexia. It was Artesia Mortgage at the time. And they were basically the Belgian central bank's U.S. commercial real estate lending arm. And I joined them to ramp up for a CRE CDO. And we were getting ready to launch that. And the financial crash took hold in 2008.
No, had you seen it coming? Like when the bottom started falling out, did you connect it to all of those shaky loans that you had seen coming across your desk?
Well, I think it's fair to say I was. In fact, many of my colleagues at Fitch Ratings would remind me that I was frothing at the mouth many times in New York, saying this is all going to end in tears. And, you know, the writing was on the wall in so many ways to those in the industry. And I expected the contagion to carry over to the CMBS market as well. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say that I did see it coming along with a lot of others in the industry. But going back to Artesia or Dexia, I moved there to Belgium. They relocated me to Belgium to help their ABS team work out that portfolio. And that's really my first run-in with the U.S. market and its credit issues in underwriting and commercial real estate loans. As an investor, you know, I looked at what the servicers were doing. And on one hand, you had the worst credit underwriting period in history, you could say with a straight face. But on the other hand, you had limited putbacks for misrepresentations and warranties. You know, if a loan is misrepresented, the lender has to sell the loan back because it lied about the loan quality, basically.
So you had a lot of lying, but nobody was
calling them out.
Nobody's calling them out on it, right?
Yeah. And so I, you know, would pick up the phone and get on the phone to, you know, the stateside servicers and say, you know, what the hell's going on? And they were very responsive. And the same thing was happening in Europe as well. In 2013 and 14, Dexia was renationalized into the Belgian Central Bank because of, you know, their exposure to ABS. And they said all foreigners go home. and, you know, which I was one. And they were going to send me to New York, but I, you know, we were going to end up in Australia at some point. So I decided to go straight to Australia. But I kept my eye on the U.S. market, and I saw that CMBS borrowers were getting raked through the coals when, for example, a default occurred on their underlying loan. The servicers would not call out the lender liabilities. You know, many times I would see halfway built, not halfway built, maybe 75% built buildings being sold as fully complete. I'd see undisclosed environmental catastrophes on loans being sold undisclosed, halfway occupied buildings being sold as fully occupied. You know, the issues go on, and all of those are misrepresentation. And so my tactic that made me unique in the market was that I would take these issues and I would say, well, look, there's also lender liability here, and servicer, you have an obligation to call these out. And you have to, in fact, it's your obligation. And they hated me for it. You know, they weren't used to anyone bringing liabilities to the table. And I got a bunch of successes under my belt. You know, I worked for the first 6 months at a private equity firm. And then me and two guys took off and carved off CRE loan advisors. And, you know, I was achieving discounted payoffs for borrowers of up to 70%. Of their loan. So, you know, meaning that the borrower would, if they had a $10 million loan, they would purchase a loan back for $3 million and, you know, the $7 million would be forgiven. So I was doing well, but then the servicers got wise to what I was doing and they kind of stiff-armed me and, you know, refused to work with me. That was as the market was turning. You know, the whole market was expecting this whole waterfall of maturities from badly underwritten loans in the 2005-2008 era, as they matured, the whole market was expecting these loans to default upon maturity from 2015 to 2018. Well, they were defaulting and servicers were foreclosing on assets and they were building up these assets on the quote-unquote trust balance sheet to many billions. But then in like 2016 and 17, they started selling these loans en masse, not selling, but refinancing them en masse into new CMBS 2.0. And CMBS 2.0 is basically any loan sold after 2013 under new, better structures, new and better, kind of tongue-in-cheek there. And, you know, everyone blamed... They blame the good performance on, number one, new entrants into the loan market, new lenders, non-bank lenders, right? Also low interest rates and a positive economy. I remembered back to the Fitch days and thinking, well, no way, you know, did they get refinanced? So I dug deeper and dug deeper. And I basically followed the premise that, look, if the information was difficult to find, then you should go through hell and high water to get it because there's something there. Part of the solution that they came up with was that investors should have a one-stop shop to get all their information that they need in CMBS. So that solution was for Wells Fargo to generously operate a website portal that would make all this information available to investors and servicers and rating agencies and analysts. And that website is ctslink.com. So the big data feeds that come through there and feed into the models, into the waterfall of the CMBS structures, which are very complex, those automatic feeds were taken from CTS Link and then put into the models, which, by the way, are now totally black boxes. It used to be that you had to model out the waterfall, but now they generously do that for you. So as an investor, you don't even have to worry about the waterfall because now... You know, that's all modeled out for you, of course, by the banks or by the loan sellers.
So, Wells Fargo, what could possibly go wrong?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. With Mint Mobile, you save money and get quality service. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/deconstructed. That's mintmobile.com/deconstructed. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/deconstructed. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
John Schwartz, you know, you've done a lot of reporting on Wells Fargo in the past. And, you know, both you and I have been talking to John Flynn a lot over the past year, sussing out what he found and fitting it into the historical context of the financial crisis. And what parallels did you find?
Well, you know, if people think back to what was going on in 2008, if you're following the news then, it was this incredibly confusing swirl of acronyms and numbers and so on. But in fact, what was happening was not complicated at all. The thing about Wall Street is it really only has about 4 basic scams, and it just continually runs them in different combinations in different ways. And the particular scam of the housing bubble in the 2000s was counterfeiting. So everybody knows regular counterfeiting is you just print something that looks like money, but it has no actual value. What Wall Street was doing in the 2000s was they were printing another form of paper wealth bonds that had some value, but much, much less than they purportedly did on their face. So to understand this, you have to think about sort of regular mortgages in the past and how mortgages began to be issued more recently, including the 2000s. Mm-hmm. So people think about, like, I want to buy a house. I go to a bank. They give me a mortgage. They loan me money. And then I have to pay that bank back over a period of 30 years. Now, in the past, if you think of, like, It's a Wonderful Life.
I'm in trouble, Mr. Porter. I've got to raise $8,000 immediately.
The bank there, when it was making loans, cared whether they could pay that loan back.
Well, what kind of security would I have, George? You got any stocks?
No, sir.
Bonds? Real estate? Collateral of any kind?
Oh, I have some life insurance.
Yes. How much is your equity in it?
If you loan someone money, you want them to be able to pay you back. But what happened in the past couple of decades was the development of something called securitization with mortgage loans. And so what that means is one bank would issue the loan and you'd get the money, you'd buy the house, but they would then take that loan and sell it off to someone else. So the incentive to make sure that the person could pay the loan back dropped significantly. And they would sell these loans off, usually to another bank. Then banks would take these loans, say 50, 60, 70 loans, package them all together into something called a trust. And then the trust would issue bonds based on the loans that were part of this pool. Now, if in fact those mortgages had been correctly underwritten, if people could actually pay these loans back, then that's a great deal. You know, you buy one of these bonds and then you get regular payments over, you know, a period of years. But what happened in the 2000s was the development of something called liar loans, where banks no longer cared about whether a loan actually was correctly underwritten. And so they had a great incentive to just collect the fees for originating the loans. So they wanted to issue as many loans as they possibly could. So they would find lots and lots of people who actually could not afford to pay this money back. They would find someone who's a bartender in Florida making $25,000 a year. And the bank would claim in the paperwork that they were actually making $300,000 a year, you know, so they could afford to buy a house that cost, you know, $1.5 million. And so all of these bad loans would go into these pools, into these trusts, and then the bonds that were issued by these trusts were essentially counterfeit. And that is the thing that turned it into such a catastrophe in the 2000s, because you would have pension funds that really do need regular income buying these bonds. And when the whole thing collapsed, both sides were ruined. You would have the people who had taken the loans out to buy homes, they would get thrown out of their homes. The pension funds, they would be not getting the payments that they had counted on. The only people who profited were the middlemen, the people who'd done the packaging, like Countrywide was notorious for this. They would have made hundreds of millions of dollars on all of these packaging fees. And so that's what happened then. What seems to be happening now is potentially something not in the residential mortgage-backed securities market, but in the commercial real estate-backed securities market. So that means loans that are based on mortgages, you know, for shopping malls or hotels, things like that.
Right. So John Flynn, as you start digging deeper into the underlying documents behind the CMBS loans, you start to find something that looked a little bit similar to what John Schwartz just described. When did you start to realize that you were onto something fairly huge?
It was in 2017, late 2017, basically. You know, I started out doing, okay, I'm just going to do 10 of these and I'll see where it goes. And all 10 of them were inflated. I'm like, what? And so I kept going from there, basically.
And before you go further on that, I have been blown away by how hard it was for you to find what you found. You know, you shared with us all of the different documents and you walked us through, you know, how to confirm everything that you were saying. And even with all of those documents already in front of us and the path, you know, and the roadmap of how to get there, it took an enormous amount of work because of the changes of address, the changes in the names of these loans. So explain to people what they would have to do if they wanted to do the same thing that you did.
Well, the data feeds that I was referring to before, none of the comparable data to compare two sets of numbers, you need two sets of numbers, right? Mm-hmm. So none of the comparable data is in the data feed.
Which is wild, because wouldn't investors want this comparable data?
Well, yeah, an investor that is curious, certainly they would want that data. But again, they're managing billions and billions. And do they have the incentive? Mm-hmm. And would they do anything about it? I don't think the average investor would rattle the cage of a bank who is doing this, because number one, they wouldn't see any deal flow because, you know, the wealth management arms are closely tied to the same large banks sponsoring the deals. Mm-hmm. So they don't really have an incentive to do it. And plus, the lawyers for the banks got wise to the kind of tactics that they used for RMBS litigation, and they patched up, or they kind of rigged the decisions and the courts, so that it's a very difficult path to walk to actually bring a case to either put back a loan or to do otherwise, change a servicer or whatever.
So there's no point.
Yeah, there's no point. So getting back to the steps on how to do it, the building name and address changes is something that I was aware of earlier, you know, when I started representing borrowers. The first 5 minutes of the conversation would be to establish, are we talking about the same building? You know, the borrower would call it, you know, building XYZ, and the bank would call it building ABC. And sometimes the building location would change. I mean, it would actually change the physical location of the building, you know, if it's the same collateral. So even if a investor was curious, it would be very difficult for them to do it.
Right. So these banks are changing when they're refinancing these properties, they're changing the address and they're changing the name of the property. So any attempt to kind of compare the numbers that they were using to finance it the first time around, to compare that to the numbers they're using to finance it this second time around, it's not entirely impossible, but it would take somebody an awful lot of time. Am I right?
Yes. And it raises a lot of doubt. You know, you have to be certain when you're doing these comparisons that, you know, building A is building A.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many legitimate reasons for changing a building name, right? And there are some legitimate reasons for changing an address, but not on the scale and the systematic mm-hmm. scale that I see in the data.
And so as you would compare the numbers from one pile of paperwork to the next pile of paperwork, even though you'd find this, it was representing the same year, you kept finding the income inflated. Is that right?
Yes, in short.
And so what else could account for that other than the obvious?
Well, the main thing that people put forth is adjustment for capital expenditures and for tenant improvements and leasing commissions, or TILC.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes place when an underwriter is estimating the income for a building, the net income for a building. There are expenses that have to do with the integral structure of the building, and those are capital expenses. There's also operating expenses. So what mm-hmm. one does when they underwrite a loan is they split out the operating expenses from the capital expenses and make adjustments in the expenses. And so that's what they put forth as an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But in both cases, in the old and the new trusts, the underwriters were normalizing expenses. So that wasn't an explanation. And they were following mm-hmm. guidelines, industry guidelines, in doing so. And in many cases, the different cash flows that were being reported were made simultaneously as the loan was being sold into a new trust. So the reporting in 2015 was done, you know, in maybe in December 2015, and a different loan for the same collateral was being sold in like January 2016. So this reporting is only like months old, right?
Right.
So, you know, how does it change so drastically in that month? And it shouldn't change at all, because you're talking about the same time frame, same collateral,
right.
Same circumstances. So it shouldn't change at all.
Right. And so you found that often these numbers were different. How often was it that the error was inflating the amount of income? Just like how John Schwartz talked about the bartender who said that he or she was making $300,000 a year. How often was the number inflated, and how often did you find it deflated, where they kind of stated the income in lower than it was before?
Oh, it was inflated over 90%, mm-hmm. Maybe over 95% of the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I never went back and measured it because, you know, this is very laborious work.
Right. And so what's the function of that? What's the benefit to the lender?
So the liar loans in RMBS, the credit driver for RMBS is the borrower's credit, the borrower's income. And the credit driver for CMBS mm-hmm. is cash flow. Cash flow is king, right? And so if you inflate the cash flow, you, of course, get a higher income
mm-hmm.
that increases the what they call the debt service coverage ratio, which is the NOI, the net operating income.
Mm-hmm.
And there's thresholds called for under guidelines, under regulatory guidelines, that loans mm-hmm. have to meet to be sold into a pool. And so that is the benefit is, number
right.
one, that they get the loan sold that is an otherwise unsaleable right. loan, right? Benefit number two is it can load on more debt because with that NOI increase, it also increases the value, so they can load on more debt. Number three is they show a less volatile cash flow profile of the underlying asset, which less volatility is a higher credit quality, right?
Right. So there's an extraordinary amount of benefit to the lender to be able to inflate
yes.
The cash flow that their borrower claims to have. So, you know, John Schwartz, where do you see this going from here?
It's tough to predict. Yeah, this is a situation, a huge financial crisis, where you would expect any kind of fraud to become apparent. Like there's a very famous Warren Buffett quote where he says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming naked. And that is the problem that happened. You know, that's what happened in 2008, is that when the economy collapsed, everything that had been done in the residential mortgage-backed security market became apparent. It's happening to some significant degree now. We have some graphs and charts in our article that people can consult where the companies, you know, shopping malls, hotels are having a very, very hard time paying back the mortgages that they had taken out on the properties. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see if it's as big a catastrophe in as it was in 2008 or if it's, you know, something different.
And John Flynn, you know this industry well. Where do you think it's headed? The Federal Reserve is playing an interesting role because it seems like there could be a significant amount of economic downturn and fraud combined that if the Fed soaks enough of it up, can just keep kind of limping along. You know, as Keynes said, you know, we're all dead in the long term. So it could limp along in the medium term or in the short term. What's your read on how much trouble the industry is in?
Well, look, we're in a low interest rate environment right now, right? So the hunt for yield is on. Any money out there needs to be placed to earn a yield, any kind of yield. And CMBS still offers a reasonable yield as compared to treasuries. And so the demand will still be there. And if there's no accountability in this low interest rate environment, all they need to do is inflate numbers again. So it may, to get, you know, these troubled loans refinanced, people say, oh, how are they going to get refinanced? Well, they could just create value.
Same way they just did.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
Well, to that question, why wouldn't you? John Schwartz, what is your read on what the Biden administration could do about this?
Well, if indeed this was fraud on the part of any of the players, you know, generally speaking, that is illegal. If the Biden administration wants to actually enforce the law in a way that the Obama administration did not in 2009, then they have many, many tools to do so. And in fact, it is happening already that the SEC is getting involved in the kind of litigation and enforcement that you would expect to see in a situation like this. The FCC just filed a lawsuit against a credit rating agency for manipulating its CMBS ratings methodology. Another credit rating agency has already paid $2 million in fines to settle an SEC suit. So the government can put a stop to it. They can hold the people responsible. The issue is really one of political will rather than, you know, some sort of like abstract capacity. Like they can do it if they want.
I mean, let me interject there. Everyone points at the credit rating agencies as the culprit, you know, but they're easy targets because they can't fight back, right? They don't suffer any damage or blowback from the credit rating agencies because, you know, they're not the banks, you know, they won't suffer in deal flow, et cetera. But the real culprits are the ones doing the inflating.
Would rating agencies have to be fundamentally differently structured to be able to catch what you found? Like this isn't, like my read is that this isn't exactly them asleep at the switch. It's that they don't actually even have somebody stationed at this particular switch because they kind of take lenders' word to a certain degree and then look at things above that. They're not doing the laborious work that you went through.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. No, they have to take the lender on their word, right? You know, the issuer pays model is inherently open to that, open to abuse. You know, maybe take a page out of China's book. You know, you have to do some enforcement on it, basically. But again, it's only their opinion. And they say that very loud and clear. It's only their opinion.
Right. Well, John Flynn, thank you so much for walking us through this.
No, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And John Schwartz, thank you for collaborating with me on this story. This was something to get our hands around, but I hope that people start to pay attention to it.
Yeah, I hope people can take a look at this. It is the kind of thing that, you know, it takes a little while to understand, but once you do understand it, it really is incredibly interesting.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
That was John Flynn and John Schwartz. You can read the story that John Schwartz and I wrote, The Bigger Short, at TheIntercept.com. And a big thank you to everybody who became a member of Deconstructed last week. The promotion did so well, we're extending it through the end of the month. If you go to TheIntercept.com/give and make a donation of any amount, you'll get a signed copy of my book, We've Got People. Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our producer is Zach Young. Laura Flynn is our supervising producer. The show was mixed by Brian Pugh. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Betsy Reed is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. If you're subscribed already, please do leave us a rating or review. It helps people find the show. And if you want to give us feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much, and see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.